Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast, number 16, for June the 2nd, 2014. As usual, when I'm getting ready to do the cast, I'm trying to think of what's going to be the theme, the focus, the heart of it. This one, I'm a little undecided. You know, I'm always trying to keep it fresh and not have, you know, too strong of a go-to that, you know, only a small group are interested in. Some subjects, you know, produce a lot of stuff to talk about. The wireless one comes to mind. But the name one brings a lot, too. Like, for example, this morning I just thought I'll quickly look on Google News in case there's, you know, any news, anything that, hey, how could I not talk about that kind of thing? And it appears six climbers are missing on Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier, 14,000-foot mountain. Mount Rainier is in Washington State. And it's a pretty serious mountain. I told you I'd been reading about Ed Visters, the first American to climb 14 highest peaks in the world without using oxygen. You know, first of all, to climb these peaks, when you read these books, just to do it, pretty serious endeavor. You know, as these guys were doing it, these early guys, Ed Visters was an early guy, and of course, Reinhold Messner was the first. As these guys were doing it, you know, their friends were doing it, right? You sort of notice, hey, I've done Everest, and I've done K2, and I've done some names I can't pronounce, and Annapurna. And then they, you know, you want to collect the whole set. You do it by default, right? You get into an activity, a hobby, and you do it by default. But, you know, the dark underbelly of climbing is how dangerous it is. You know, for many people, it's not a dark underbelly. It's, you know, very visible and very up front or on top. But for these great climbers, these climbers that take on the very toughest peaks that their whole life is climbing, they put all their, you know, time and energy behind it, it becomes their hobby, their vocation, their interest, their job, and you commit to it. Pete's. You know, Ed Visters, he did climb the 14. He figured that about half the time he didn't get to the top because he deliberately turned around. Ed Visters, you have to give him credit and, you know, give him a sort of an honorary, the head of an honorary category. My fridge is just turned on. I've noticed, you know, background sounds now with this super sensitive mic. I've noticed when the fridge turns on, it adds a background sound to these casts and it makes it harder for me to edit them. I have to, you know, on any quiet spots on the track, the background sound is really loud. Anyway, I'll try not to let it get me down. But Ed Visters, he's the honorary head of the category of those who have turned around the most and still climbed all 14 biggest peaks because, you know, the kamikaze pilot comes to mind, right? That was a pilot that was trained to do a suicide run. And there's something, you know, faintly suicidal about trying to climb these mountains. They're not automatic. They're not gimmies. Some of them are extraordinarily dangerous. K2 and Annapurna are basically tied for the most dangerous. But still, these guys, these great climbers, would go to some of these other peaks. And the end of the story, the punchline is, he was never heard from again. One of the things that can happen is these guys lose their conditioning. You have to condition yourself to climb. You have to spend time at altitude to get used to more altitude. And you can't rush that. And so, you know, in a way, bad weather when you're at base camp is a good thing because you have to hang around and drink tepid beverages and reconnoiter, and your body's acclimatizing to the altitude. If you don't do that, when you start climbing higher, suddenly your body starts failing, and you get pulmonary edema and cerebral edema. Basically, your fluid balance in your body gets out of whack, and it either affects your heart or your head, and you start to lose it. You can die in a very short period of time just because of that. You know, these guys, some of these climbers, you know, they want to do it solo, or they get forced to do a new route. In the middle of the route, they get forced to do a new route. They're Herculean adventures, and every adventure is different. Honestly, every mountain for each person is different. Like Ed Visters, I think he climbed Everest half a dozen times. Well, each climb where he climbed it, just as a climber, he climbed it without oxygen. But he had a rule that whenever he was a guide for other people, he insisted that he use oxygen because he wanted to be clear-headed. He didn't want to have, you know, lack of oxygen being an excuse that he didn't do his job well. Like I say, he really took this seriously, the responsibility aspect and the getting home aspect of climbing. So of these climbers on Mount Rainier, it's a challenging mountain as it is. Oh yeah, the reason I started talking about Visitors was that he used to be a guide on Mount Rainier. And so for him, Mount Rainier became his backyard, his little bump, his little toy hill. In the early days of my watching the NFL, Jerry Rice was my favorite player for years. And he scored the most touchdowns and the most yards. And, you know, he still has records to this day. And one of the things Jerry Rice did was he never got out of shape. And he was one of the first to do this. In the off season, he would keep on training. And Jerry Rice, in the back of his property, he had a hill. And he would run up and down this hill each day type thing. And, you know, guys would come and visit him, you know, probably other football players and, you know, the like. And he'd probably, you know, half the time say to them, hey, let's go for a run. And then go and run up this hill. Well, of course, Jerry Rice was in shape for this hill, right? He did it every day. He knew all the ins and outs and he knew what to expect and his body was used to it. And, you know, the number of times you hear the story of someone running along with him but only getting halfway up this hill and, you know, Jerry goes to the top kind of thing. That's the kind of preparation you need to be number one and to not get injured and to have that great career. And it's the same in climbing. I just finished reading a book on Reinhold Messner. One of his books, he's written a lot, usually they're in German. Hey Reinhold, if you're listening, please send me some English translations of your books. They're not all that expensive, but I don't have all that much free cash, so. Dear Reinhold, from your biggest fan, please send books. But I did read the one where he solos Everest without oxygen. You know, Reinhold always pushed the envelope. Reinhold and, I wish I could remember his main climber buddy friend without having to look it up. I would recognize the name if I saw it, if that's any consolation, but they became famous for scaling European mountains quickly. Prior to them, people mounted expeditions. They took metal with them. They took anchors and pitons and ropes and nothing wrong with taking a rope, but, you know, they would take large amounts of rope. On K2, there was a big accident on K2 in 2008, and one of the things was that one of the expeditions laid out humongous quantities of rope, but they also did it wrong. Apparently, they started laying out rope as soon as they left camp, one of the camps, where things weren't particularly tough. And then when they got to the There's a steep cliff on K2 that is where, you know, the slides are. You can't avoid it. Very steep. When you see photos of people trying to navigate this area, it's unreal. It's almost like in The Matrix, you know, when Neil Gill was outside in his office at the start of the movie and the guys are chasing him and he's told by Morpheus, you know, okay, you got to do what I say. Go outside and start walking along the window ledge. That's how precarious this section of K2 is. Well, needless to say, they run ropes there, right? But, for example, some of the things that happen is the slides take out the ropes. And in 2008, that's what happened. Bang, one guy was gone, and the ropes were cut. And now these people had to down climb. They were late in the day. They were too late because there was too many of them, so they held each other up so that the whole thing was too late. They should have gone to the summit. And now they're stuck in the worst possible place. It's dark. And they have no ropes. Well, you know, accidents don't just happen. They're often, you know, occasionally something will break or fail. But, you know, you got to have a belt and suspenders. You got to have some climbing ability. You can't just trust some ropes. And when there's too many climbers on the mountain at once, you got to go, hey, not today. This is going to end badly, etc. You have to have a set of operational principles. So Messner came along with his climbing buddy, and they started taking on these peaks with direct ascents. Like, not, you know, taking the long road around and not doing all the expedition style. And then they call it alpine style. And so they would climb, you know, the Matterhorn in one day. They were just like, hey, let's go climb the Matterhorn. I mean, they were prepared, but they'd just go straight up kind of thing. And it was revolutionary. Messner then proceeded to apply this to Everest. And he is the same famous climber friend. They took on Everest, and it was just the two of them, the last, you know, so many thousand feet, without oxygen. And they brought that alpine light style to Everest, and also climbed it without oxygen for the first time, the two of them. After doing that, the scuttlebutt the troll comments were that Messner had little miniature cans of oxygen on his person and was secretly breathing oxygen without anybody knowing it. This is just so ludicrous on any kind of a level. It's childish and embarrassing, but this is what led to Messner going, "Oh, you didn't believe me on that one? Well, I'll go by myself." How much can you carry by yourself? You're really limited. He even had his tent was specially made. You know, I know I talked about this last week or the week before, but now I finished the book. He had a special tent made that he could fit himself in if he scrunched up, like fetal position, or, you know, pulled your legs up, like not even stretched out, but only weighed 2 pounds. A little half-inch foamy he took along, which is kind of interesting. I need a foamy when I try and camp. You know, I think a lot of climbers don't take a foamy, but... So he climbed from the Chinese route. He had a girlfriend sort of thing who accompanied him. Wasn't like, you know, doing the work or doing the final stages of the climb, but... And then he had an interpreter and a Chinese, you know, Communist Party type. And they didn't go too high up. His girlfriend went to 6,500 meters, which is sort of like the high base camp. She shared her own notes. In his book, he publishes her comments. What's interesting is that Messner has become someone that people attack. And it's sort of, well, it's typical of the trolling factor in life these days. But you can't attack this guy. It's like attacking Gandhi and saying, oh, he snuck food on the side, or Gandhi wasn't the first to go on a hunger strike, or why didn't he go on a hunger strike in this case or that case? It's like that. That's where we've come to today. The point is that the people that do that obviously are supremely sick. They are jealous. And jealousy is a very ill-recognized, rarely recognized condition. We don't recognize when someone else is jealous, and often we don't recognize it when we are. And it produces kind of horrific, submerged problems that they pop out in weird, random places, and you have to trace it back and trace it back, and then you go, oh, it's because the person was jealous. So much of trolling is people that are jealous. They don't do anything themselves, and so they have to attack somebody else. I found it interesting that Ed Visters, in his otherwise excellent books, and I read at least two of them, he did show contempt for Reinhold Messner. Now, when he was younger, Reinhold Messner was his idol and whatnot, but he ultimately sort of conveys a thumbs down on Messner. I don't think it's justified at all. He's contemptuous of Messner at high altitude, where Messner, you know, for one thing, when he's climbing, Messner sometimes thinks there's someone behind him. You know, a person, another person on the mountain. Well, first of all, Messner's not the first to have those thoughts. And second of all, what Ed Visters is not taking into account is when you spend time in a super, ultra-quiet place by yourself, it is a haunting experience. And you become super attuned to your environment. And the littlest pin drop, you start interpreting and you start sort of overreacting to it. I've been in super quiet environments when I worked on the railway. One of the territories I worked on went near the Columbia River, and this is the Columbia River in British Columbia. So eastern British Columbia. It's off the Rogers Pass Highway, the highway between Revelstoke and Golden. And first of all, in that 60-mile stretch between Revelstoke and Golden, or I'm trying to remember if the camp was 60 or the whole thing, because I was in a camp halfway. Anyway, in that whole stretch of 60 to 100 miles, let's say, there's a little park. There's a little, you know, restaurant tourist shop in the park. That's it. 60 to 100 miles. And this is, by the way, the number one highway. In Canada, there's a highway called the number one that goes across the entire country. It's like the Trans-Siberian Highway in Russia. Yeah. Canada being the second largest country, this is a long, big, long highway. Well, it runs through the Rogers Pass. So the point is, even on a number one highway, this is maybe the longest stretch where nothing is going on the whole highway. Then you get to our camp in the middle. So the camp is in the middle of nowhere. And then you go out on this little speeder and you get to a point which is at the edge of our territory. They built the Revelstoke Dam, one of these giant dams. British Columbia built big dams. The Revelstoke Dam was 90 miles north of Revelstoke. So the road I'm thinking of is an east-west road. But this dam was built 90 miles north of Revelstoke. And that's where it dammed up the Columbia. and then the Columbia backs up on an angle back down to the number one highway. So if you can visualize, think of the letter A. The highway is the bar in the middle of the A. The left slanted side of the A is the road going up to this dam. And the right hand side is the river and the dammed lake coming back from the dam all the way to the highway. It's like a triangle. The interesting thing, my grandfather and grandmother, they drove that highway. They went to the Mica Dam when it was built. My grandfather was sort of a pioneering spirit. When there was a new highway, he'd say, come on, we're going. And he and his wife would drive the new highway. He loved to drive. Every Friday, I think it was, they would go for a drive, even when they're in their 80s and almost 90. The two of them and his sister, my great aunt. Her name was Lydia, but for some reason, I have loved to know why, we called her Auntie Died. Died. That was like the name we called this poor lady. She was so sweet. A spinster, you know, unmarried for 90 years. In her own little world, she loved reading. She loved nature. I got to know her. She sort of reminded me of like a pet. You know, some people, they say, oh, you never see that cat. She was kind of like that. She didn't seek the limelight, to say the least. She just did her own thing in life, and my grandparents supported that. She lived with them, and oh dear, fascinating, fascinating people from another era, truly. Anyway, so they drove to Revelstoke, to the Mica Dam. I went to the Mica Dam. This is 90 miles north of Revelstoke, on a road that there's no service, there's no gas, you know, no nothing. Nothing point, nothing, man. Just a road. And you get to this dam, it's beautiful, fantastic, big dam, serious dam. It's one of these great dams in the middle of nowhere that only British Columbia has that sort of thing. British Columbia has a lot of dams. I've seen quite a few of them, because I work quite a few parts of the province. I think it's 600 feet high. To give you a comparison, the Hoover Dam is 660 feet high. So this is 90% of the height of the Hoover Dam. It has a little set of steps. You can walk up and down these steps on the side of this dam. I did that. And as I was doing that, I realized, what would happen if you started falling down these steps? It's like the mountain climbing. Good luck to you. What's going to stop you? The bottom. Went inside, saw the turbines. It's one thing to sort of be aware, oh yeah, a dam is kind of big and you got these things that spin around, you get power. But when you're next to it all, it's like the Seattle Space Needle. By the way, I think I'm setting a record for jumping from one topic to another without finishing any of them. Hopefully I'll remember what I was talking about. The Space Needle, oh yeah, it's high and it's got a restaurant on top and it turns around and it looks like these three, you know, trees growing together kind of thing. You know, you sort of have a quaint little perception of it. It's also in the realm of 600 feet high. We went there a few years back now. In fact, I just had part of my morning cup, I have a sort of a spillover cup when there's a little bit of extra from my French press. I put it into my Seattle Space Needle cup. I love that cup. It's really beautiful. It's like sort of a shades of gray, black and white, you could say, but it's really more like a shades of gray cup. And it's got the picture of the Space Needle all the way on the outside and inside the cup. Very elaborate, intricate ceramic cup. And it has a special feel to it, and I love, you know, sort of finding an excuse to drink from it. My other cup, just to continue the record of distraction on this podcast, is called the Oceanfront Deli. It says, and it's a beautiful picture of the Oregon coast. And it's this little shack, this little restaurant and place where you can stay at, that fronts right on the ocean. We went there some years back, and we didn't really have the money. We don't really have the money to do a lot of camping in a nice little cottage on the ocean kind of thing. That's expensive. But I had enough money for this mug. And, you know, I really try and take the memories with me. You know, rather than being sort of perpetually unhappy and wishing you were doing something, you can have good memories with you. And if you think about those good memories, you are experiencing that again. You're getting the feel with me that I rewatch things and revisit things. That's my mug, is I'm revisiting the ocean. I'm looking at it right now. It's just a beautiful sunset scene on this mug. It's really spectacular. And it was like, you buy the mug and you get one free cup of coffee with the mug and all for $10 or something. It was like, hey, that the price is right. Wow. Now let's hit escape a few times and go back to where I was talking about. So I was talking about Mont Rainier. Oh yeah, I was talking about the Space Needle and how it's deceptively enormous. Here's an example. You get to the Space Needle, and then you're about to walk inside, like, in the bottom is a gift shop, a really spectacular gift shop. If I won the lottery, I'd go to the Space Needle gift shop and buy a few things. They're expensive, but really, you know, kind of awesome. Well, just before you go inside, one of the legs, one of the footings of the Space Needle is right there. And, you know, those three sort of supports that go up to it? Well, when you trace one of those supports back down, it sits on a pedestal, right? Well, this pedestal's obviously hefty. And each of these three supports is bolted down. And the bolts are hefty. There's like getting towards 100 bolts for 1 foot of the pedestal. And these bolts are thicker around than my arm. They're the biggest bolts I've ever seen. They're at least 3 or 4 inches across. Maybe. And that's the bolt part. And then the nut is maybe 6 inches across. And so we went inside, went to the gift shop, and I had to inform them, and I just calmly informed them that I was looking at one of the supports, and it seemed one of the bolts was loose. And then I just sort of walked away like I had done a service. Well, of course, it would take a great force to loosen one of those nuts. I mean, seriously, if you hooked up, in terms of leverage, if you hooked up the appropriate wrench, I don't think a human, even if that wrench was 4 or 5 feet long and you had a couple of humans on it, I don't think a human could turn the nut. You would need some kind of mechanical assistance. And that's probably how it's done, with, a very powerful electric motor that you hook onto it. Not like it's done a lot, of course. But, that's a form of security. Good luck trying to unloosen any of those nuts. All right, so we're talking about dams. So that's escaping out of that. Get in, ye escape ye. We were comparing the Micah Dam, right, Revelstoke. So I go there, I go inside. So you see these turbines, you go down, and it was almost unsupervised. The whole tour, everything was like, there were so few people there. In fact, what I remember, it was in the entranceway, it was all sort of wide open, like you walked across the dam to access the inside of the dam. And you walk up sort of these shallow steps, where you take a small step up, but it has a large walk across portion. And like I say, it's all open. You go inside, and now you're inside the building, and you're walking along. And there was a squirrel inside the building, because there wasn't a door. I think at an inner point there was a door, but for some part of the shelter of the structure, there were no doors. That's how I remember it. Or the door was propped open. I had some peanuts or whatever, and I remember feeding this little squirrel inside of this enormous dam, this 600-foot-tall dam. If you're in any given city, a 600-foot building is one of the tallest, if not the tallest, things in that city. And this dam produced 2.7 gigawatts, 2,700 megawatts, about a quarter of what the Three Gorges puts out, something in that range, or maybe a tenth to a quarter, something in that range. It's a hefty dam. And BC's got quite a few of these. And so you go down on this tour, and they open this little door. And you think, oh, we're going to look at the utility closet, where the guy keeps the mop and the bucket. No, you're going to look at the shaft that's being turned by the water. And this is like a little inspection point where you can look at the spinning shaft. You get inside this room, it's noisy, to say the least. It's like you were on a ship and you were watching, with the propeller, the shaft that would drive the propeller. It's like you're watching that. This shaft is 6 feet across. It fills the entire room because it's even bigger than the room. You're in this little room with a ceiling, but the shaft is like filling the room, spinning like mad. And it's all solid metal. The power, I guess the equivalent is like being near a train, bigger than a truck kind of feeling. The rumble of a train or of a very large Caterpillar tractor. It's just enormous power. And that was like, yeah, in this room we got this little shaft thing here, and okay, next. That was a great little experience. I didn't feel comfortable driving 90 miles up a road with no support whatsoever, no gas whatsoever, and then having to drive 90 miles back. That's when I realized I am sort of a city person, and I'm not comfortable taking the risk of going out on a limb. Not very often, I'll put it that way. There has to be a sufficient safety factor, or I'm not comfortable doing it, period. I just don't want to do it. That's where I'm different than these climbers. These climbers are driven. Again, one of the things that's sort of interesting when they start trolling each other, some of them trolling the great climber, Messner typically, is they start questioning his motives. Why does he do it? Apparently when he gives talks, and he does this all the time, it's one of the most common questions, why do you do it? Why do people drink? Why do people collect dolls or coasters from bars? Why do people watch golf all day like I do when I'm working on a project and I got golf on in the background? Why do people, you know, there has to be a limit on your questions. There has to be a reason for your question. You know, these trolls, they forget their own humanity. We're curious. We want to push our limits. We want to see what's out there. What is it? What happens if I touch that little bare wire and get a little shock? For some people, they get their kicks out of that. For me personally, I don't like shocks. I don't even like static shocks. It goes through me and I feel it. I'm not comfortable. By the way, speaking of that, if you're in a situation where you might receive a shock, put your left hand in your pocket, figuratively speaking. This is an old electrician's tip. When you get a shock, it goes through your body to ground. And that's the part that you feel, you know, I'm getting a shock. So it takes conditions being right for you to get that shock. In other words, you have to have a source of high energy, electrical energy, like a static charge. And then you have to be grounded. If you're wearing insulating shoes, you're not going to conduct as much. Well, if you put out your left hand and touch something that's going to give you a static shock, it will go through your left hand, through your heart, as it makes its way down your body, and then it'll go out your feet. Well, going through the heart, it's like a wasp sting versus a bee sting. If you use your right hand instead, you'll get that static shock, but it'll be like a bee sting. If you use your left hand, it'll be like a wasp sting. And yeah, if it's enough juice, it can kill you by going through your heart and stopping your heart. So that's a little electrician's tip. If you know you always get shocked by opening a door of a car or whatever, use your right hand. On that first touch, anyway. Okay, now this is going to be a challenge to escape back here. So we're talking about shocks. I was talking about how I don't like to take risks. There has to be sort of a reasonable level of risk. And then these trollish people. Oh yeah, and they were challenging, why do you do stuff? Yeah, for some people they like shocking themselves on purpose. You know, so it's not a valid question. 30, 40 years ago, we wouldn't ask, why do you do it? Because if we asked it, we would ask it in a reverential way. Wow, man, why do you do that? All that hardship. Even though we know why they did it, we're impressed. They challenged themselves. They did something no one else has done. They got the sense of accomplishment. When you go through a challenge, you learn, you grow, you expand. I think humans have sort of forgot these days how to expand, the importance of expanding, why you expand, and we certainly have very little clue of what happens when we don't expand. That's what the age we're in. We're in a non-expanding age, with the exception of wireless. Wireless is expanding like jackrabbits, like lemmings, like dandelions, like starlings, like rats. So many fields, there's no progression. Physics, sadly, other than my own theory, there's no progression. The same subjects come up in the stories constantly, to the point of it being humorous. I had one exception to that. There was one interesting physics story recently. And what made it interesting was it was some guys who have confirmed a theory, and the theory is directly consistent with my own. So it's nice to see these sort of subtle supports of my own theory. And that's what spring and loop theory is and has become, is a fantastic lens to look at things. If it doesn't jive with spring and loop theory, it's probably wrong. That's powerful. It's like a truth serum, a truth lens. Because what it says is the spring and loop theory model is correct down to its core. So when you strike that bell and it resonates down to your core. A physicist, speaking of physicists, and his wife, a famous physicist, wrote a book called The Ring of Truth. Big tome. I should check it out again from the library. I think I even owned it at one point when I used to buy books. Boy, I wasted a lot of money buying books. He was an interesting guy. He owned some radioactive material, like a big blob of it. I guess it glows in the dark type thing. It's that radioactive. You know, he's out there. He's an out there physicist. But he talked about the ring of truth. Physics has lost the ring of truth. For the most part, most people don't have it anymore. The news media, they're shameless. They have no shame. They will print all kinds of garbage articles. They don't care. They don't care if it's right today and wrong tomorrow. That suits them just fine. And if you don't have that ability to filter out what's true and what's not, you're going to be yanked around by the nose ring. That was a sort of a saying, a concept I remember coming up with some years back. What is a nose ring? Well, yeah, these days humans do, but in the time when I came up with that, not many humans did. Creatures that did have a nose ring were cows, bulls. And you'd tether them with the nose ring. Well, the idea being that you don't want to yank your, have somebody grab onto your nose and yank your nose. So that was a pretty effective place to put a tether. It's the same with us. We are tethered. You know, when you're addicted to something, that's your nose ring. The fridge is going on again. I'll be curious how loud these are on the recording. It makes me want to have a studio, which is our cone of silence. I need a Maxwell Smart from the TV show Get Smart. I need him to come along and design me a cone of silence that I can slip over this wonderful desk that I have. Then I can be in a studio, and the dogs can be scratching around me, and refrigerators can be running, and locomotives a quarter of a mile away can be passing by, and you don't hear any of it. All right. So these trolls, and why do you do it? People being led by the nose ring. So it's the cow with the nose ring going, "Hey, Mr. Wild Horse, why do you run free?" And that's what Reinhold Messner is. Reinhold Messner is a true free spirit. If ever there was one. And, you know, this can rub people the wrong way. That's ludicrous for people to be bothered by it, but it shows people's own insecurities. Many people are very insecure. They need support constantly. Well, it's the definition of a lack of support when you climb Mount Everest alone without oxygen. He even specifically avoided any kind of radio. He had no way to radio the base camp. By the way, when Messner came back down, and then the girlfriend Nina, N-E-N-A, came up to meet him, he broke down. It's hard to say when you read his account translated from German to English, you know. Basically, apparently she came up to sort of greet him, and he just cried. Harrowing experience. A very, very challenging experience. Ed Visters, you know, he's fond of sort of giving other climbers a hard time, usually when they're too risky. Well, having read Messner's climb, I gotta say, the guy's not very risky. In other words, he's smart about how he does it. First of all, his reconnoitering, his reconnaissance, his preparation, his studying of the mountain, his ability to tune into the weather is phenomenal. Excellent. Ed Visters, he gets satellite weather forecasts. And as the quality of the satellite forecasts and the internet come along, he mentions it in his books that he's getting even higher quality weather predictions. When you're climbing on a mountain, another issue is, where's the trail? Next time you go climbing anywhere, or go on a hike anywhere, first of all, you're probably climbing on a trail. I remember climbing the Lions in British Columbia. It's 5,500 feet, and it's truly from sea level, and suddenly when you get to the top, you are 1 mile in the air. It's a hefty mountain, very, very steep, awesome mountain, classic look to it, great views. Our family did it. It was like the most amazing climb that our family ever did. But as you were climbing, you would notice they had these little yellow pieces of plastic sort of stuck to the trees periodically. Someone had just stuck very simplistic markers on the trail. Even with that, even with the herd of people that were climbing up and down that mountain, probably we passed 100 or 200 or 500 people. Probably 500 people climbed the mountain that day. Maybe that's an exaggeration. Let's say 200. Hundreds. But the point is that you're never far from people, and you're on a route that it's like it's a straight line. This is not a complicated route. And yet, you realize your dependency on those markers. Okay, so now let's take a different situation. You're climbing a mountain where there's no one else. There's no trees. So there's no, oh yeah, that tree has, you know, no branches on one side type thing. There's no rock. Messner climbed Everest alone without oxygen in the monsoon season. Well, the monsoon season, when you're at 20, 25,000, 30,000 feet, that translates to snow. He climbed it during the snow season. So not only are there no tree landmarks, there are no rock landmarks. There are no landmarks. The scale. When you're climbing a mountain that's 29,000 feet high, it's big. It's big in all dimensions. It's big horizontally. He climbed from the North Ridge. You climb from the China side, you climb from the North Ridge as opposed to the Southwest, Col, as they call it. And the North Ridge is really long. So he has to keep track of his route. And conditions were so bad because he's climbing in the monsoon season, the moist season, when he got to the top. And, you know, he could take pictures and then he'd get sucked in. And then a few minutes later, he could sneak another picture kind of thing. And isn't that sort of anticlimactic? You get up there and he has some spectacular photos, by the way. I mean, wow. As good as I've ever seen from Everest, top of Everest. And then he's sucked in. He had to do a self-shot, self-photographs where you set the camera up on the tripod and then you walk 10 feet away and you turn around and the camera goes click. Let me tell you, when you're at that altitude, exhausting to do that. And of course, Ed Visters keeps talking about how just to take your gloves off to do that photo, you run the risk of frostbite just doing that one action. Well, Ryan Almester takes a lot of pictures throughout this expedition, throughout this climb, this solo alpine-style climb. So what does Ed Visters do when he's climbing mountains? And he preaches it. I mean, Ed Visters is preacher-like with his points. Well, he takes what are called willow wands, basically long sticks. He takes bundles of long sticks. And when he's climbing, and especially the tougher sections and the high-altitude sections, he lays out these wands every, 50 or 100 yards. And the idea is when you're coming back, you can see these wands. And then he talks about sometimes, the snow or the wind conditions push the wand over. And now he's in trouble, Well, Ryan Almester had no wands. But Messner talks about this, and he talks about how at certain points he would look back and he'd make a mental note of where he was. Ryan Almester was doing all the things that Ed Visters was worrying about and preaching about, and using the support of others to get around. Messner was doing it himself constantly. Ed Visters talks about, someone does an amazing climb and you get back to a camp and they've got, beverages for you, and they greet you and here's your beverages, which, because you're super, super thirsty up high. You get more thirsty, you're exerting yourself all day long, you're not hungry, and gruel, liquid refreshment is all you got. Super valuable. And even just taking turns, preparing the beverages, which of course Ed Visters always said that he always climbed with others. And so, you'd get back and one of you would be in charge of making the tea, the hot water, and the other one, would rest, and then you'd take turns, right? Well, Messner had to do all of his own beverage making. He talked about it one of the days where, he climbed and he did his 1,500 meters of climbing, about a mile. He's 6,500 meters high and he climbs about a mile up. So at altitude, to climb a mile by yourself, phenomenal. He's a little disappointed. I think he climbed like 1,200 meters. He wanted it to be 1,300 or something like that. And then he has to set up his tent. It takes like an hour or two. Simple little tent. Then he has to get inside. He can barely get inside. He brings his backpack inside, partly to keep the tent from blowing away. He's not staking it down. He just doesn't have the manpower, and he can't carry all the material you need to stake that tent down. I've set up tents for our family when we go camping, and the tent bag and the tent pegs and everything else, I'd be surprised if I could carry everything I need just for my tent, even if to carry it for 5 minutes. And that's to do it right on a tent, so that you can be there a while. We use a ground tarp, and then the tent, and then lots of stakes on the tent, and then we put a top tarp on. And we have the largest tent you can buy, because we have our dogs inside the tent, and we have one of them inside her kennel, inside the tent, and we have tubs when we go camping, tubs with all of our clothes, clean clothes, dirty clothes, etc. We're pretty comfortable when we camp, but means you need a lot of space. And so I have a giant tarp. I think it's like 20 by 30. I think it might be 12 by 24 now that I think about it. 12 feet wide, 24 feet long. Basically, it's getting close to the floor area of a house, this tarp. And that goes over the top of the tent. We have a favorite campsite that has enough trees around the edge that we can secure this tarp. It's elaborate. It's exhausting. Setting that tent up and the tarp, I'm exhausted. At my age, I'm no longer a perfect physical specimen, not that I ever was. But it wipes you out. You get into camp, you've driven, I'm not going to say all day, that's ridiculous, I've driven for a few hours. Got to set the tent up, I've got to set up whatever needs to be set up, the minimum stuff. And maybe exhausting is not fair, but it's several hours of hard work. At least an hour, hour and a half of hard work. In a known campsite, with all the materials that you need. And even assistance. So imagine doing it 8,000 meters up. You have to find a spot. How do you find a spot that's suitable? You have to kick the snow out of the way. Think how exhausting that is. You have no way to anchor your tent. So, like I say, you need to bring your backpack inside the tent to act as a weight to help it not blow away. You have to cook inside your tent. This tent that you can't get your whole body length into. You have to scrunch up to get into it. Then you get your backpack in there. Then you get your little stove in there. It takes something like an hour to produce like a cup of liquid. All of these climbers talk about how arduous it is to make this tea, to get enough fluid in you. Messner did it all himself. He took photos of his little, they call it a bivouac. When you get high up, you don't have a proper tenting situation. Sometimes you bivouac without a tent. It's like, where did you crash? There comes Tank. I had to let Tank out, and I'm going to try and keep talking here. Even though he's outside, he's going to disturb me in a minute, but I don't want to lose my train of thought. We're talking about bivouacs. Basically, sometimes you get stuck out on the mountain where you're not at a camp. Can't make it back to a camp. And in the case of Messner's case, he knew that he was going to have this situation. He was going to have no choice but to crash out on the mountain several times, twice. Ugh. Basically, when he hears stories of horror stories of climbing on Everest and K2 and that, frequently it involves people getting stuck out all night. The famous Krakauer novel, Into Thin Air, and the movie, which Into Thin Air is based on. I think it was 1996 Everest, where all these guys, people died in different ways, for different reasons, but bottom line, because there was too many people on the mountain. And how David Brashears was one of the people that, I think he didn't die, but he got frostbite and all that. And I think it was Weathers, there was a guy Weathers, I think he's a doctor, they thought he had died. He bivouacked out in Everest overnight, and then they found him, and then turned out he was alive, and they rescued him. Rob Hall was one of the people doing one of the expeditions, a New Zealander who did perish on the mountain, and Scott, somebody, his partner, Scott Ball. But Rob Hall, he bivouacked high altitude overnight. People kept talking to him on the radio, and they tried to get him to get going, and he never could get going. Basically, he just ran out of steam. Well, Messner, he's bivouacking not once, not one night, but two nights on the mountain. That in itself. No oxygen. These other people had oxygen. No support. No people making him beverages. And he gets back down again. Truly Herculean. By the way, at the start of Messner's climb of Everest alone without oxygen, after he's left, their advance camp was at 6,500 meters. Within an hour or two of leaving and starting to climb up the mountain, he falls in a crevasse. So you're by yourself, you fall in a crevasse. That's a gap in the thick snow that you're climbing over. You know, it's like an iceberg. Think of it like that much snow. And then an iceberg has crevasses. It has places where the ice is not solid. And then on top, you get snowfalls, and the snowfalls can gradually, through drifting and various things, they can cover over. It's like you lay a man trap, and then you cover it over with leaves and sticks. And you walk on the leaves and sticks, and you fall into the trap. That's what crevasses are. They're a super big issue for climbers on snow. Well, you rope up when there's two of you, right? One of you falls in, the other one pulls them out. When you're on Everest, which has become like rush hour traffic, then they put ladders over the crevasses and they string ropes through the entire crevice field called the Khumbu Icefall. They string ropes through the whole thing. And you still have tragedies there. So, on the one hand, there's no gimmies. It is a risky thing. And on the other hand, most people have a lot of support to deal with something like crevasses. Well, Messner's by himself. His support? None. He falls through the crevasse. He's falling, sensation of falling. And by a fluke, he lands on a ledge inside the crevasse. As he gets his bearings and puts his light on and starts looking around, he sees that the ledge, the thin ledge that he's on, he has to cross the remainder of the crevasse. He basically slides down inside of this gap to a ledge, and then the crevasse keeps going, but on the other side he realizes if he steps across the crevasse, the gap inside this crevasse, he can get onto a ledge on the other side, and he can climb out. And that's what he proceeds to do. So he realizes as he looks around that he can literally walk out of this ledge, so first of all, Messner realizes he has to step across a crevasse. Now, I've had to step across gaps in dangerous situations, and one of them was on the Lions, at the top of the Lions, when you're going across the back of the Lion, then you have to go up to one of the heads. There was like a gap, and then you had to do this vertical rock face. No ropes. Hordes of people are doing it. totally risky. 500-foot drop-off on one side, you would fall to your death easy. I went, no. My older brother, Alan, who was the most adventuresome when we were all young, he starts climbing. He gives up. He comes back down. Very tricky. Even coming down, I mean, that's actually more hard than going up. All these other people around us are just swarming up and down this thing like ants. But I realized I wasn't comfortable stepping across that 3-foot gap. I think I eventually might have maybe reached my hand across. So under perfect conditions, I wasn't comfortable doing that. Well, here's Messner. He has no choice. He has to step across this gap. And then he has to carefully inch along this sloped ledge. So then he gets out of the crevasse. Well, now he's on the downhill side of the crevasse. In other words, he still has to cross it. I've been in snow conditions where there was another time when I was on Mount Baker and I was snowshoeing. Super simplistic mentality, you just snowshoed across this nice open area, and then we went, started going up this hill, and then we, as you got near the top, there was like this sort of spire, this more vertical stretch, and it was like, hey, it'd be nice to be on top of there and see what the view's like, you know? You're going up this slope, and then you realize the slope is really steep, and it's kind of avalanche prone. Not avalanche prone in a, you know, you're going to die sense, but it's very steep, it's very compacted, and hey, you got to be careful. So we're going up, we're careful, and then we get to a point where, in the summertime, clearly, I don't know if that part, the snow melted in the summer, but you realize we're climbing on snow, and the top, there's some snow as a cap on a stone top, if that makes sense. So think of it like you have a stone cylinder, you have a little cap of whipped cream on top, and then you have some snow leaning up against the stone cylinder. We were climbing up the snow leaning up against it, but it's all so big that you don't really get this sense until you get to the top where there's a gap. There was a gap between that snow and the top portion, and suddenly you had to do a bit of climbing to get to that last, those last 10 feet. I gave up. I was like, I'm not going to risk myself. No, thank you. You know, you got to be able to give up at the last minute. So in that sense, I respected Vistors. Anyway, so Messner, he crosses this crevasse. By the way, when Messner fell into the crevasse, he said, first of all, you know, he realized he was lucky to be alive even in the crevasse, never mind getting out. Then he realized he could get out. And when he was basically in the crevasse and he was in the middle of things, he had the thought of, when I get out, I'm not climbing anymore. Like, I just got to save my life and that's it. Well, as soon as he gets out, he's like, next thing you know, he's climbing again. It wasn't even a big decision. He just kept on with it. Oh, gosh. Messner. There is nobody like Reinhold Messner. There is no one close to Reinhold Messner. And the training, the running, he looks like this fit machine boy. He looks like a mountain man. He truly does. Even when he's just training in the Tyrols. He's from northern Italy, the Tyrol, T-Y-R-O-L area of northern Italy. But apparently they speak German there, so he's, I've always thought of him as German, but I guess he is technically Italian. Maybe it's an interesting combination, German and Italian. But he sure takes a lot of heat from people that know nothing. Nothing. People that have accomplished nothing. People that they couldn't stand by themselves if they had to. And they ask him the nastiest questions. They say the nastiest things about him. Messner, he just likes being away from humanity. Being away from the craziness of life. And by the way, that's a 7 quality. Well, Reinhold is 224. Messner is 123. 347. 7 destiny. If you had to sum up a person with one number, Reinhold Messner has a 7 destiny. You sum him up with the 7. He's the lone wolf. He's the guy that likes being by himself. Period. No apologies. He likes being by himself. By the way, Ed Visters. Visters. 887. That's one thing you'll see around mountain climbers. The 7 quality. Another one you'll see is the 1 quality. Messner, 123. Edward of Ed Vister, 641. With this Mount Rainier incident, I might as well sort of bring my way all the way back to it and talk about it a bit. They haven't released all the names of the climbers because, of course, I'm looking for 775s. But every one of the climbers and people that are associated with this story, they're all 1-ish and 7-ish. Like there's a park ranger talking about the story. Her name is Fawn Bauer. Fawn, 178, 1-ish. Bauer, 922. Okay, neither 1-ish nor 8-ish, but when you put the two names together, she has a 191 total. 1 destiny, super 1-ish. She's got 3 ones in her name. Well, the 1 is that physically strong, pioneer, can be by themselves quality. So here she is, you know, giving the report of the story. another guy. He's the head of this group of climbers on Rainier. They were part of Alpine Ascents International. And the spokesperson, the head spokesperson right now for Alpine Ascents International is Gary Harrington. So you're looking for ones and sevens, right? Gary 156, Harrington 718. So he's got both in his name. Let's just scroll through some of the names. They did give some of the names. I'll see if I can bring them up. I brought up different versions of the story because they don't have much information, so you have to look across multiple stories. I remember one of the guy's name was Matt. Matt is 189, so there's the one. And by the way, these six, they think they've died. Well, Matt, with that name, they say if you have that 189 combination, it'll shorten your life. Well, it appears to have been the case in this one. The founder of Alpine Ascents is Todd 617. I'm sort of working these out as I read it. Oh, his last name, Burleson, B-U-R-L-E-S-O-N, 527. Accident looking for a place to happen. And when you add Todd and Burleson together, he has a 5 destiny, the accident destiny. So that's the guy who's the head of the organization that was behind these climbers. He has an accident looking for a place to happen and a 5 destiny. Well, it seems like both happened on this case. Looking through these stories here, because they did mention some names. Basically, I can't give a full analysis because I haven't got all the names, but consistently I did see the 7 popping up. And the reason I guess I'm focusing on that 7 a little bit is climbing is a 7-ish endeavor. And this is podcast number 7. This is podcast 16. 1 and 6 is 7. I wanted to talk about that a little bit. You know, when you analyze someone's name and you start doing the numbers, crunching the numbers, it seems like a video. Oh, here's another person. So here's another spokesperson from Mount Rainier Parks, Patty Wold. So now you're looking for one-ish, right? Patty. Patty is 123. And if she goes by Pat, it's 191. So she's one-ish. And then with Patty Wold, W-O-L-D, last name, 639. No, the 9 is losses, so she fits into this story. And then with Patty Wold, she has a 753 total. There's the 7. And with Pat Wold, she has a 1 destiny again, just like the other person. You may recall I said that people with that one destiny, they have hard experiences. Well, imagine you work on the mountain and this happens. Bottom line, hard experience. Hard for you to be a spokesperson. Just trying to find a few more names because they were very scattered. One of the climbers released, the family released his name. There was a mark in there, which is, of course, a 7-ish, 1-ish, and 7-ish name. So I want to talk just briefly about the numbers and how do you... What's with all this adding and weirdness in when you analyze someone's name? There are 9 qualities. There are 9 steps in life. There are 9 chakras. The Kemmler philosophy, the principles behind it are the principles of the numbers from 1 to 9. And there's no getting around it. There are these basic qualities. The 1 is the seed, the start, the pioneer. The 2 is the environment, the fluid, the support of others. The 3 is... You know, like the song says, 101 don't make 2, 101 make 1. Well, when you get the male and the female together, they don't make 2, they make 1. They make a child, right? And that's the 3, that's the light. The 3rd planet from the sun is the earth. The hardest planet, the most solid planet, the 1 quality. Yeah, Mercury. It's just a big, hard thing with no liquid, no give. The 4th stage is the root system. The plant needs a root system. So you plant it, that's the seed. In an environment, that's the 2. You get the little shoot coming above the ground, like I have in the backyard a thousand of right now. The conditions are perfect this year for seeds, weed seeds typically growing really well. And even tree seeds. And the tree seeds, it's interesting, the way they blow around, they blow into clumps, and then you get a clump of tree seeds all in one spot. And I was pulling these little clumps, and these are little shoots. They're smaller than alfalfa sprouts, to give you an idea. But you get a clump of 10 of them together, and you grab onto them all at once, and they come up in a real clump. I was just surprised how clumpy these groups of 10 at a time, leaf, tree, seeds, shoots were. Anyway, so that's the 3rd stage. So the 4th stage is you need roots. Without roots, that plant is not going to grow. It's not going to survive. It's not going to thrive. The roots are like the subtle, not very visible, but super important thing. And then the 5 is the rapid growth. If you have all the conditions and you've got the right soil and you've got the good root system established, then you get the rapid growth. Well, after the thing has grown really rapidly, you get buds. You get the plant saying, hey, I got to look after the next generation. That's the responsibility, the seriousness of the 6. That was last week's talk. And then you get the 7. The bud turns into the flower. The flower is paper thin. The flower is such an intangible thing. It's mysterious. And yet behind that flower is going to be the fruit. And the fruit is nourishment, and it's the seeds for the next generation. So the seven is the flower, the eight is the fruit, the nine is the ripening of the fruit, the full formation of the seeds, which is the most important part of the fruit, except to a human. And then in the ninth stage, that fruit falls to the ground. It has a loss. Plop. That ripe apple falls to the ground and settles in for a long, cold winter where nature rests and the seeds wait for the cycle to start again. So there are only nine numbers. Well, let's say it's the year is 2014. Well, what year is it if there's only nine numbers? And so we would say you would add the 2 plus the 0 plus the 1 plus the 4, you'd get a total of 7. The world is in an 8-year. 2014 adds up to 7. Well, it's like when you are 1 year old, you're in your second year of life. I'm 56, I'm in my 57th year of life. This earth of humans, this society or world society or whatever you want to call it, humanity, we're in 2014. But that was at our birthday, it was 2014, right? And now we're in our 2015th year of this human era. So that's the 8. So why do I turn 2014 into 7? Think of it like you have a dial, you know, like a clock has 12 numbers, right? What's 13 o'clock? 13 o'clock is 1 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, in military time, they don't have 1 o'clock. It's either 1 in the morning or it's 1300 hours, the equivalent of 1 in the afternoon. So 13 can be reduced to 1 when you have a system based on 12. Well, 10 can be reduced to 1 when you have a system based on 9. So it depends on your basis, how you reduce something. So basically, in our decimal system, which we think of as a 10-based system, there really are 9 numbers plus a nothing number. The nothing number is the 1 moved into the next column. It's the cycle starting again. So we go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then what we think of as 10 is 1 in a new column. It's the clock that got around to 1300 hours. It's 1 in a new cycle, the afternoon cycle. So it's an entirely rational reduction of multiple numbers to one number. This podcast, number 16, 1 and 6 is 7. And as I was trying to lead up to this podcast, boy, did I put a lot of thinking into what was I going to talk about. And what was interesting was nothing was coming to me. With the different floodcasts, depending on the number of the floodcast, like when I was leading up to the 5 one, I had tons to talk about. It just took off, the rapid growth. Last week, you know, it was a bit more cerebral, but still it was, you know, relatively straightforward. But the 7 is where we're supposed to turn within. That lone wolf, the loner, the person who loves nature and climbing out in the elements, that 7-ish person. That's nature saying you need to spend time by yourself so that you can think deeply about life. And that's why the 7 is very misunderstood. And by the way, at the heart of those 775527 accent looking for a place to happen people, at the heart of them is the 7. They're misunderstood. They are all misunderstood. There was a story that I was going to talk about before the Mount Rainier accident story. It was a few days earlier that happened this last week. Samuel Frappier, age 19, got stuck on the east face of Long's Peak Mountain Tuesday night. The teen from Quebec, Canada, spent the night on the mountain after calling park officials from his cell phone. He told rangers that he was uninjured but could not move from his position. A 28-person team arrived on Wednesday to rescue the trapped teen. So you look at Samuel Frappier. Frappier is 628, so he's 988, 628, 7 destiny. Makes sense that he's out climbing. And by the way, he's climbing by himself, isn't he? There's no mention of anybody else with him. He wants to be by himself. And this is, you know, looks like he's going to end up favorably. You know, with his names, he's got some strong 8-ish names, and the Frappier name is a balanced name. It's a good name. So he's going to do okay, right? He had his cell phone, and he's called for help, and he's going to be all right, right? Still, he had an event happen to him that doesn't happen to everybody. Why? Well, do you think his friends call him Samuel? They call him Sam, right? I don't know of any Samuels, but I do know of one or more Sams. Well, a Sam Frappier, 775, bingo. So I was going to talk about this 775, and instead I'm talking about Alpine Ascents founder and his 527, both of them leading to climbing tragedies, right? All right, just to round up this 7-ish, analyzing the names, 7-ish out in out of nature, Floydcast. Might as well do some updates along the same subject line. Donald Sterling and his wife, they've signed away the team. They're going to sell it for $2,000 million. He bought the team for $12 million. So he's going to have a rate of return of about 160 times, 16,000% rate of return over a stretch of 33 years. So basically in his life, how did he afford it 33 years ago? I mean, he's 80, 33, so he was 47 when he bought it. So he had already had a life before he bought the team. And now this team has gone from $12 million, $12.5 million to $2 billion. That's pretty awesome. But this is the guy that is a racist. This is the guy that said horrible things, crazy horrible things. Mr. Axel looking for a place to happen, and then he just attracted this maelstrom of other sevens and vibes and created this huge conflict, truly over nothing. Nothing, i.e. he shouldn't have done it. Anyway, it seems like he's going to land on his feet, doesn't it? His punishment for being a racist and in public kind of thing is he's going to get $2 billion. Well, if you recall, way back when this event first happened, I said I predicted he was going to get off. Basically, that bad things weren't going to happen to this guy. And honestly, it makes me wonder at this point, was this all manufactured to help him sell the team? Because look at the publicity he got. The hue and cry, the outcry, right? Apparently he's ranked, supposedly right now, as the most hated person in America, which is ridiculous. I don't hate this guy. This guy expressed an opinion. It's not a pleasant opinion. It's not a healthy opinion. It's not a nice opinion. He expressed an opinion. He didn't kill anybody. He didn't poison anyone with fluoride. He didn't even take any money from anyone. Actually, he's paying thousands of people's, probably, hundreds anyway, hundreds of people's salaries. He just has the kind of opinion that shouldn't have got out in the street. That's what he has. And he's entitled to an opinion on the scale of big deals and small deals. This isn't that big a deal. There are plenty of people that have strong opinions. I have strong opinions. I consider fluoride as a poison. I never talk about fluoride supplements. They are fluoride poison that we are being lied to and convinced to take under the guise that they are good for us. But they are absolutely not good for us. That's a strong opinion. You say that to a dentist and they look at you like, oh, well, this is an oddball. Dentists are in love with fluoride. Do we hate dentists? I don't trust them, but do I hate them? It's funny, I had an incident with a dentist. He was covering the main dentist. They had holidays that week, and the last time I went to get my cleaning done. And the person who does my cleaning, I have this one person. I always like this one person because I have bad teeth. I'm English, right? It's a requirement. My bad teeth came from brushing too much when I was younger with a very hard bristled brush. We didn't have soft bristles in those days. What we considered soft then would be a medium now. I used a hard brush. For years, I literally scrubbed the gums right off my teeth. Not a good thing. Well, my teeth, despite that, have stabilized. And of course, despite avoiding fluoride for over 30 years. Funny thing, my teeth have stabilized and I have had almost no cavities since I was in my early teens. So I've gone 45 years without teeth issues, basically. How can that be? No fluoride. Anyway, sensitive teeth, so I have this one cleaning lady, and after her cleaning, she did an outstanding job. Fantastic. I'm just so pleased with the state of my teeth. This guy comes along, he's the backup dentist, and he wants to give me x-rays, and I'm like, no thanks, I'm fine. Because when they take x-rays, they find nothing, and it's sort of x-rays with dentists is a way to find business, right? Because they see little tiny things, and they're like, oh, you got this tiny little speck here, let's get rid of that speck. And they got to drill a big fat hole in your tooth to get rid of that speck, right? You have to be able to anchor the filling material. So I'm like, I'll skip all that when it's a little more visible. Not that there is one, but if instead of looking with a microscope, let's just look with our eyes, shall we? So I was like, no thanks, on the x-rays. Well, he's like, no, you don't understand, basically. You have to have x-rays. We reserve the right to refuse service. If you don't want to have x-rays, then we reserve the right not to care for you. I'm like, what? And, of course, follow the money, right? Turns out that dentists are a monitored group, professional group that's expected to follow standards. And if the dentist doesn't thoroughly check you out and then you get a cavity, supposedly they can be liable for that. And so to protect themselves, they bombard you with x-rays that are designed to kill you subtly, in a small way kill you. Finally, I realize, okay, I'm really stuck here. And I was like, okay, fine. Next time I come, because, I mean, that visit was done, which is like 4 months from now, I'll get an x-ray. And he's like, no, you don't understand. That's like the minimum, and it depends if you, That's if your teeth aren't bad, you know. And if your teeth are bad, you're going to need more than that. And now I'm looking at this guy like, I really don't like you. And I came away with, first of all, the cleaning, and the way I came away from that was, I was like super high. Like, I don't want to say, make it sound like I was on drugs, but felt really, really good. It was one of the best feelings after cleaning I've ever had. This guy comes along, and it was easily the worst experience I'd ever had, back to back, from high to low, bang. This guy upset me. So I sent an email to the parent company. There's like a parent company, and they have multiple locations. And I let them know my thoughts about this person. I emailed them, and then they phoned me, and then we talked. Long story short, the lady, who was very smart, handled it very well, she said, we get it. We get where you're coming from. You don't have to go into any more detail. And we'll take care of you, and we'll make sure that you and this guy don't meet again. Well, it turned out my wife had this guy, because she and the kids went just a little bit before me. I shop on Tuesdays. Dental thing was on Tuesday, so I went after my shop, and they went before. And so, anyway, he gave her something like 13 x-rays. 13 individual doses of x-ray radiation in her mouth. That's ionizing radiation. Not non-ionizing radiation like microwaves, supposedly less harmful. 13 doses of ionizing radiation with no reason, honestly. No reason at all, except, well, the time has come up. It's been so many months since your last x-rays. We got to irradiate you. Turns out when you fly across over the poles and you go from, like, you know, North America to Europe, you get one chest x-ray of radiation. So my wife did 13 trips over the poles and one visit from this guy. Wow. Oh, wow, man. Some people are truly insane. This guy was the mad dentist. I was so unimpressed with this guy. I suggested that he might be better in another profession. I suggested he be a traffic enforcement person. He should be the guy who gives out tickets, parking tickets. Because that's a cutthroat business. That's a business where you're giving people bad news nonstop. And you have to be very thick-skinned. And this guy was perfect. Absolutely perfect. Okay, so Donald Sterling. So this dentist to me was worse than Donald Sterling, for what it's worth. More destructive? Physically destructive. He assaulted my wife, as far as I'm concerned, with x-ray radiation. Highly offensive dude who I will never forget in my whole life. Anyway, so Donald Sterling seems to have fallen and landed on his feet for some reason, just as I predicted. By the way, there was a story just a day or two ago. It says, earlier in May, two neurologists conducted a number of brain tests on Sterling, who is 80, at the urging of his family. A source said, their diagnosis was that he was suffering from Alzheimer's disease and likely has been for 3 to 5 years. Well, this is called putting a nice little cap on things so that you will never touch this guy, so that you will never have any way to come at this guy. You'll never have any way to sue him or anything like that. That's what that's all about. I heard this guy's recording of what he said to his girlfriend, and I've cared for Alzheimer's people. I've cared for 3 or 4 of them. For, in some cases, thousands of hours. I know what an Alzheimer's person is like. They have no cohesion to their conversation. In one guy's case, he had no ability to talk at all. Like, he could say a sentence or two, and then he was like a little sparrow flitting from one thing to another. He had no ability to focus his attention. He had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's for less than 3 years. Other people, they tend to get kind of nasty with Alzheimer's. Because they're not happy. They know something is wrong. They lose interest in reading. They sure as heck lose interest in going to a sporting event. Their world shrinks. It's like the Star Trek Next Generation episode where Dr. Crusher, the crew, the ship, shrinks. She doesn't know what's going on, and there's supposed to be over 1,000 people on the ship, and then she talks to the captain, and it's like there's 200, and then there's 100, and then there's 10, and then she's frantically running around, and she's the only one on the whole ship. Kind of an interesting episode. That's what happens with an Alzheimer's person. Their world shrinks. They lose all the connections of all their memories. It is tragic. And it's nothing like my perception of Mr. Sterling. Nothing like him at all. When I heard his conversation with his girlfriend, it was about as clear and lucid and as pointed and as precise and as businesslike as any conversation I've ever heard anyone have with anyone. He was like a parent giving a child advice, which, you know, was a little bit offensive in the sense that he's 80 and she was a girlfriend, but of course if he's 80, she's probably, I'm guessing, 50 or younger. But so that difference, 30 years, that's more than the difference from a parent to a child. But he was giving her advice in his mind. And with different words, you would have said, well, he's giving some wise advice, all his years of experience. What I'm getting at is that's the opposite of how an Alzheimer's person acts. An Alzheimer's person doesn't remember what they did yesterday. They don't remember what they did sometimes 1 minute later. I've seen it. Losing track of what they're doing from 1 minute to the next over and over again. Not just once, of course. Sometimes I forget what I'm talking about 1 minute later, but this is over and over again. So, just interesting, when billions of dollars are involved, what's really going on? What's really going on is I think this guy sold his team. And he sold it for a record amount of money. It was valued at about 600 to 700 million. He sold it for three times that. Well played, sir. Well played. Oh, and by the way, Steve Ballmer wanted to buy Clippers. That was a little minor story, as it turns out. I mean, he did buy them for the $2 billion, but as someone on Slashdot said, the most hated man in America has bought the Clippers from the second most hated man in America, because Steve Ballmer is a not well-respected member of the computing community. In other words, it just seems a perfect fit. What I wanted to do was give the other side of the coin. Those are all sort of bad stories with the numbers. And I wanted to give a story of a guy who also happens to be seven-ish. And it was a good story. And I was thinking maybe in the future I'll try and balance it out so that you can see what happens when someone has good numbers. What are the kind of things that happen? It's a little harder to find them. They don't make the news, right, normally. Okay, yesterday, rugby sevens. Rugby is typically played with 10 or 11 men. I don't know the exact number. And there's a more exciting version of rugby called rugby sevens, where seven members on a team. Well, you do a lot more running when you have seven members. And I guess there's a tournament going on in America right now at the college level, college teams. It was on TV yesterday. One team is obviously better than the other. They score a try right away, so they're leading. The other team is struggling and whatnot. Getting near the end of the game. Game's almost over. One of the players on the winning team commits a foul. Like, he, instead of just giving the ball to the other team, he kicked it, like sort of like trying to waste time. He gets a yellow card, which in rugby sevens means you're in the penalty box. You get a 2-minute penalty, just like in hockey. I've talked about this in basketball, where you don't get a 2-minute penalty for anything, and you should. It would totally change the game. So now the winning team is short a player. The losing team, the guy gets the ball, bottom line, he races down the field like mad, this incredible play, and he scores a try with zero time left. In rugby, they don't blow the whistle precisely at when time expires. You get one last go. You know, whoever's got the ball, you get one last effort until a whistle. Well, the whistle was after he scored. Each team had now scored two tries, but one team had converted both their tries, and the other team had converted the first one, and now they had to convert the second one. Well, the kick. When you score a try in rugby, wherever you touch the ball down, that's where you kick your conversion from. And you draw an imaginary line, draw straight up from wherever you touch down, out a fixed distance, and then you have to kick from there. Well, it can be a very severe angle. These guys, when they did their conversions in that, they did the drop kick version. They didn't do the put the ball on the ground and then kick it on when it's on the ground version. Well, drop kick is tougher. So it's a tougher type of a conversion, which I assume is only for the rugby sevens. So it's faster, much faster. That's probably why they do it. The whole pace of the game is faster, more exciting. So you have a harder type of conversion. You have the worst case scenario of where you're doing the conversion from, and you got to kick it through the uprights from an extreme angle. The guy who scored the try proceeds to kick the conversion successfully, and he tied the game, meaning that both teams advanced in the tournament, and he was the hero, the unmistakable hero at the end of this game. Well, it turns out that this guy, at the end of every practice, rugby practice, he practices for a half an hour kicking conversions. Now that's the old unsung hero, right? The guy who stays after everybody else and he just works on his game when no one's there. He gets good. So this guy, what's his name? Madison Hughes. First of all, Hughes, 865. That's a Mission Impossible kind of name. That's a guy who rises to the challenge. When they interviewed him, that's what he said. Basically that he just lived for a moment like that. And he relished the challenge and he rose to it. As Madison Hughes, 6'8" total. A destiny. Success destiny and a balanced destiny. And there he was at the end doing the impossible twice over the impossible that he had prepared for, and basically effectively winning. Even though it was a tie at the end, they both teams advanced, and, you know, it's sort of a round robin tournament until, you know, the final games, and so it doesn't matter whether you tie or win as long as you advance. And he was the hero. And that's what happens when you have a good name. Alright, I'm going to wrap things up early without doing the bad driver of the week or the rewatch of the week. Just because I've gone so long, it looks like. And so this is Floyd Maxwell signing off from his Floydcast number 16 for June the 2nd, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.